This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease. And the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app. Today.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books and Buddhist Studies with Alex Carroll.
In his recent expose, Make Mindfulness, How Mindfulness Became the New Capitalist Spirituality, published by Repeater Books in 2019, Ronald Purser, PhD, takes a hard look at the mindfulness movement that has taken society by storm. Purser opens the book by questioning elements of the movement that have led to its success. Its scientific credibility, its secular facade, the prevailing discourse in society around stress, and other topics. Purser's main concern, however, is that mindfulness is being used to reinforce the capitalist system by absolving companies of any responsibility for its negative consequences, for example, work-related mental health problems, and shifting full responsibility onto the shoulders of the individual. Purser also points out that mindfulness is being used in ethically questionable ways in schools, the U.S. military, and national governments. Purser ends the book by discussing his vision of a revolutionary, socially minded, collective-based form of mindfulness. Full of humor and eye-opening anecdotes, Make Mindfulness is a thought-provoking book that forces readers to look at mindfulness in a new light.
Ron, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
So I'd like to begin by asking you about your professional background and what motivated you to write this book.
Well, I've been a professor of management at San Francisco State University for about 24 years. And before that, I was at Loyola University of Chicago for about 7 years. So I think that has partly a lot to do with why I wrote the book, being situated in the field of management. I'll get to that in a minute, but I felt there was an urgent need for a book that presented more explicitly a critical account of the mindfulness movement, at least to balance out the overly positive presentation in our media representations of mindfulness, popular self-help writing, and so forth. So I saw the book in a way as kind of like a public intervention to kind of systematically question the exaggerated claims, the rhetoric, also to expose the ways that mindfulness was refashioned into an instrumental technique for personal gain.
So that was sort of the impetus there. So in a way, I don't see the book as necessarily a critique of mindfulness itself, but more of an expose on how it became commodified and then sold as kind of a panacea or cure-all. So that was pretty much my motivation.
And if you could present an overview of the book that would allow a reader to understand what they can expect to find in their copy, what would you say?
Well, the overview of the book is how mindfulness became a fashionable, marketable commodity and sort of presented as a spiritual quick fix, hence the title Mick Mindfulness. So, I mean, there's several layers in the book. One is sort of the crass layer of just pure commodification of mindfulness in terms of how it's even used now to sell products. Of course, the example I use in the book is Kentucky Fried Chicken has a video about its comfort zone, a pot pie-based meditation system. And then there are over 100,000 books on Amazon with either the word mindfulness or mindfulness title. And then last time I Googled the mindfulness, there were like 210 million results. So it's everywhere and it's being sold in the marketplace like any other commodity, almost like a brand or a marketing, a lifestyle. And so that's sort of the surface layer of it. But the book kind of dives deeper into how mindfulness became one of the most desirable techniques to respond to anxieties of late capitalist society. So part of my analysis is to also bring in a critique of how it's been recontextualized in Western consumer society, kind of driven by a neo-political ethos, and how that has how mindfulness has served more of a ideological function in society at large. And so that then unfolds into looking at how mindfulness in various sectors has been deployed, whether it would be in corporations or public schools and politics in the U.S. military. So that's pretty much an overview of the book.
All right. And in your book, you say that you yourself are a longstanding Buddhist practitioner. You've presumably practiced some form of mindfulness yourself for some time. And you also admit that mindfulness might have its time and place outside Buddhist context, such as for medical or therapeutic purposes. So exactly what form of mindfulness do you take issue with in the book?
Well, I take issue with mindfulness, particularly how it's used as a tool for placing the burden of social ills, stress in our society, and how it responsibilizes individuals to take full responsibility for their mental health, well-being. And so that's what I take issue with, is the way that it's often presented and framed as a individualized technique, an individualistic technique. In many cases, a do-it-yourself technique, which doesn't necessarily have to rely on anyone except yourself to manage your own anxiety and stress and emotions. So in that sense, I really take more of an ideological aim at these practices, because ideologies are in some ways quite hard to see when we're immersed in them. But they're representations of our social worlds, but they can also misrepresent our social worlds. And so mindfulness has become a practice that is complicit in many ways with neoliberal values. And so if you look at the mainstream discourse in mindfulness rhetoric, it's always the individual who has to adapt and has to cope. You know, happiness is a skill. For example, happiness is a self-contained skill that we can learn to exercise our mental muscles, just like going to a gym, which are both, incidentally, very individualistic activities. In a way, mindfulness has become part of therapeutic cultures too, which are entangled in this notion of what Nicholas Rose calls the side disciplines. And the side disciplines use institutional authority and expertise to extend government in a way that individuals become self-governing of their own behaviors. And so mindfulness can be seen as a technology of the self in terms of Foucault's understanding of it. And from that point of view, you can see why it's very, very popular and appealing, because it's seen as very benign and very benevolent. And I'm not denying at all that people do get benefits from mindfulness. But I'm looking at the other side of the coin, which is how these tools can serve the interest of corporations and neoliberal aims and political goals. So that's kind of what I take issue with.
All right. Just to follow up with that, you said you have a problem with the term the mindfulness revolution and call mindfulness the new capitalist spirituality. What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, I've always kind of chuckled when I heard the term revolution, mindfulness revolution, because when you hear the term, you always think of, okay, what's been overturned here? What's been radically changed? And if it is a revolution, it's an extremely conservative one, because it's worked cooperatively and collaboratively within institutions by using the cultural capital of – it's an elite-led movement in many ways, as Jamie Kosinski's, her book, The Mindful Elite, has already documented that. That it's an elite movement that has been able to gain access to major institutions such as schools and the military and corporations and hospitals and government agencies. And so it has not really offered any sort of challenge to these institutions that oftentimes are quite dysfunctional, quite wrought with power inequities and so forth. And so it's very apolitical in a way. Kind of, it avoids kind of any kind of vision of the social good. It's kind of a laissez-faire approach. You know, let the market decide what's you know, what will be valued. And so from that point of view, it kind of follows the history of capitalist spiritualities, as Jeremy Caret and Richard King have written in their book Selling Spirituality. So there's a long tradition of the colonization and commodification of Asian spiritualities that end up producing a highly individualistic set of techniques that are accommodating and accommodated to the dominant cultural values within these institutions. So from that point of view, this highly individualistic spirituality resembles in many ways kind of the ideal neoliberal subject. And it functions then in a way that kind of reorients the goals to a highly individualistic realm in many ways. So that is seen then as a tool that can help us cope with the anxieties of capitalism. And it's so easily and has been so easily assimilated into the marketplace that, you know, that's why I started to question what revolution? What revolution are you talking about? I didn't see any revolution. I saw more kind of a quietist surrender to the status quo of our major institutions.
And then somewhere in the beginning of the book, I think around chapter 2, you start using the term neoliberal mindfulness and assert that there's a tight fit between the mindfulness movement and neoliberal ideology. I think some people might find this a little perplexing. You know, how can someone sitting quietly in the room practicing meditation be contributing to the reproduction of the neoliberal capitalist system?
Well, part of it is that when you instrumentalize and privatize a practice such as mindfulness, it forecloses other alternatives in terms of offering a radical critique of the causes and conditions of the social origins of our suffering or the political, economic origins of our suffering. So, you know, it basically is sending the message that it's the individual that has to learn how to adapt. And so there's very little attention paid then to collective action. So it's totally aligned in many ways with the neoliberal kind of ethos. And what you hear often is, especially from mindfulness teachers, is that the only real change comes from within. So therefore, their theory of change is quite ineffectual when it comes to, if you really want a revolution, changing social, political, cultural structures and systems. So the idea is that because you're placing the burden of change back on to the individual to harmoniously try to accept and adapt to external conditions. So it may not look like there's any so-called harm being inflicted on people. Of course, there's not exactly harm being inflicted, but there is sort of a blind spot that's being cultivated with these practices, because stress is not just in the human body, it's also in the body politic. And so by constantly encouraging people to go to turn inwards, kind of the inward turn, that to me is, a political stance. It's basically saying, let's just turn inward and do the best we can to adapt to these conditions, which are often the source of the stress to begin with.
Speaking of stress, you argue that the way contemporary society understands the concept of stress is a little misguided and that this has contributed to the success of the mindfulness movement. But everyone can give concrete examples of particularly stressful moments in their life, and we all recognize what the other person is referring to. So what's wrong with the way that we understand stress?
Right. I sort of discovered this. I wasn't really planning on diving into this area of research in the book, but just the more that I did, the more I realized that the narrative, the dominant narrative of stress is one of privatization. So the privatization of stress is basically saying that, and Jon Kabat-Zinn actually, I think, expresses this in his diagnosis of society, basically saying that our cultural malaise is due to the fact that we're an ADD nation. That's what he mentions in a couple of his writings. What that does then is that it basically provides an analysis that the dominant view of stress is that we're just simply making the wrong lifestyle choices. So it relegates it to an individual lifestyle problem rather than seeing stress as a much broader phenomena that's linked to social, political, and economic forces. And Dana Becker, she wrote a book, One Nation Under Stress, and she coins the term that this is the doctrine of stressism when we see stress as, or we frame it purely as a lifestyle choice issue or it's biological, kind of like a biological reductionism, that stress is all inside our head. So therefore, it's just a matter of autonomous individuals to resolve it and to manage it. So my friend Alec Caring Lobel, he refers to this as it's like an analogy he uses is that stress is like just having a common cold. There's no cure for it. So, you just have to manage the best you can when you have a cold. So in a way, that's sort of what's happening with the stress discourse. But there's a long history behind it and how we got to where we are with that. And that's what I trace out in chapter 3 in the chapter called The Mantra of Stress. And the unspoken assumption is you hear a trope among the mindfulness people that our problem is that we've inherited this outdated, hardwired biology because back in the day of when we were hunter and gatherers and cavemen, we had to fight or flee if we were hunting. So if we came across a saber-toothed tiger, we had to run real quick and go to our cave and chill out until our adrenaline rush. But the problem is that we're inhabiting the 21st century lifestyle, so we don't have that luxury. So the story goes, we accumulate stress, we become stressed out, which is a term that really didn't come into cultural parlance until the 1980s. But the unspoken assumption is that if we had only evolved further biologically, in other words, if we didn't inherit this outmoded fight-flight system, we wouldn't have any stress or conflicts. So it's, you know, it basically is kind of sending the message that, you know, it's us that have this flawed biology, and so we have to compensate for it. It's not that the modern capitalist economy is problematic. We are the problem. And what that does is it naturalizes stress. It takes our capitalist system as a given, which we must adapt to. And that's problematic because it crowds out other explanatory narratives that could repoliticize stress as a political issue, which it is. And so by adopting sort of this dominant discourse of stress, then you're also ideologically aligning yourself with basically the neoliberal agenda. And you hear this in terms of the fear-based rhetoric that stress is an epidemic, it's omnipresent, you know. So it's up to us to mindful up. It's seen as completely an individual level problem. And I think that's where much of the self-help literature situates, kind of adopts this kind of idea. It's not just mindfulness. There's many other self-help techniques that fall into the same camp here. The culture of self-improvement, self-optimization. They all sort of basically have some cure on sale, but the cure is always put back on the individual to adapt.
Before we go any further, I'd like to stop for a moment and talk about the history of the mindfulness movement. What are its origins and where did it come from?
Right. Well, that's a complex question. There are many, many strands, many threads, very intertwined. But what I tried to do is to trace the emergence of MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, which John Kabat-Zinn started in 1979. When he was at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. That actually started out as the Stress Reduction and Relaxation Program. That's what it was first called. And it was located in a university medical center. And this was basically the outcome of a vision that he had when he was on a Vipassana retreat, an insight meditation society retreat in Bari. He had a vision that he could adapt and modify these meditative techniques, mindfulness techniques, to be used to treat people with chronic pain, other types of psychosomatic symptoms. So that was the beginning of it, but it really has a much more interesting history because he sort of built upon some of the work that was being done by Herbert Benson. And Herbert Benson was a Harvard medical doctor who was at Harvard studying at the time. He was into biofeedback, but some of the adherents from Transcendental Meditation, TM, approached him, and he began to do research on TM. And like Kabat-Zinn, he basically kind of universalized the capacity of the human body. And that allowed him to also claim there was no connections to Hinduism, where TM came from. That was sort of the beginning, but it goes further back than that too, because the form of mindfulness that we see in our culture right now really can also be traced quite far back to what Richard King calls the mindfulness-only school. And that was imported from the Burmese and the Thai revival movements during the British Empire, with the British Empire and Christian missionaries were threatening the existence of Buddhism in these countries during the occupation. So people like Ledi Sayadaw, Mahasi Sayadaw in Burma, they led a large lay movement, which opened up meditation to lay people. But by modernizing it, this is a Buddhist modernism. I'm sure you've had other guests that have gone into this in more depth. But basically, the notion was that we can strip away what we're seeing as superstitious Asian cultural baggage and reframe mindfulness as a science of mind that would be completely compatible to Western sensibilities. So it's interesting that this revival movement, though, was quite political. It was a cultural defense against the British. But it had this side effect of promoting mindfulness and making it accessible to lay people. So when people like Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein were in Asia and Southeast Asia, they were learning this modernized form of Vipassana or insight meditation. And so that's sort of the strand that led us to where we are today with clinical and therapeutic forms of mindfulness. So, and without the fertile soil of Buddhist modernism, this probably would have never taken root in the way it did, because it offered itself up as something that was very non-religious, non-sectarian, and universal, a science of mind, something that eventually would be taken up by the scientific community to actually legitimize it even further. And that's really when mindfulness, especially when the scientific studies started to be conducted and they kind of exponentially grew, that lended a tremendous amount of legitimacy to mindfulness in Western culture.
And just to follow up on that, you know, Buddhism has always been adapted to each new culture that it's spread to. So what's wrong with rebranding and repackaging mindfulness for a new audience like it's being done in the West?
Right. That is absolutely a great question. And that's something you hear quite a bit, that Buddhism has always changed as it moved from one culture to the next. So, and it's true. Buddhism, as it moved from India to China to Southeast Asia, it cross-fertilized. It adapted to other religions, such as in China. It mixed in with Taoism and Confucianism and so forth. But that was over a very long period of time. Like in China, it was like a 600-year process, and there were translators translating Sanskrit into Chinese, and there was a very long process, in-depth process of cultural and literary translation in pre-modern times. But I think what we're seeing here is something very different. And Linda Heumann, a friend of mine, actually wrote about this, I think. But we're in a different epoch in terms of all these different background assumptions and social imaginaries and Western capitalist postmodern culture, if you want to call it that, very different than pre-modern China or pre-modern Korea. So as Buddhism has come to the modern capitalist West, it's very different. It's entered a secular age. And the host cultures, I like to call them host cultures, have been primarily medicine and psychology, where Buddhism has sort of grafted itself into, as the dominant discourses have been then shaped and defined by those two dominant disciplines, psychology and medicine. That sort of shapes these practices in ways which is compatible with our popular culture. But I think there's other things happening that we may not be aware of in terms of what we may be downplaying, what we may be missing in terms of other ways of knowing, other modes of consciousness that don't necessarily conform to our Western beliefs and rationality. And so there's a strong commitment implicit, I think, to scientific materialism in the mindfulness communities. That may be compatible with modernism. True, it may, and be also very compatible with our materialist worldview. But I think there's some transformative aspects of the tradition that, because of the modernization, have been sort of set aside. And you see that more, I think, with the Theravada Vipassana, modern Vipassana, Neo-Vipassana, insight meditation strands than you do in Tibetan Buddhism. Tibetan Buddhism, although it's now also moving into a modernizing and so forth, there's a lot in Tibetan Buddhism that it would be very difficult to have dialogues with in terms of some of the assumptions that they have within their traditions and some of their ways of knowing, which are not conforming to Western presuppositions and so forth. That's a long-winded answer to your question.
No worries. Thanks for that. My next question is, you know, we've all seen footage from conferences where many of the leaders in the mindfulness movement are on stage in a dialogue with, you know, large Buddhist figures such as His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh and Matthieu Ricard. But so can we say that Buddhism and the mindfulness movement are two sides of the same coin, one religious, one secular, with the thing that they have in common being the Dharma?
What do you mean by the Dharma? Because that's a term that's contested. It's still a religious term. If you use the word Dharma, you're using a religious term. I think this goes to the rhetorical strategies which have focused on the idea that we, as Westerners, we know better because we're modern, so that we can extract what is considered the essence of the Dharma. And this is a universalizing rhetorical strategy of universalization, which has problems in terms of the assumptions that are being made when you make that move. So that requires a lot of decontextualization, which assumes then that mindfulness is a standalone technique. Number one, it assumes it has a context-free essence. Number two, and that if we can extract that essence, then we can study it as if it is something in a Petri dish that is disconnected and disembedded from its context, from the life worlds in which we say mindfulness works. Works for whom and for what purpose and for what interest? These are questions which are often downplayed in the mindfulness communities because there's the belief that the individual is the sole nexus of meaning. So these are not universal. These assumptions are anything but universal. It's sort of also, I think we are vulnerable to, as North Americans and as Americans, one of the most highly individualistic societies in the world, we have a glaring blind spot in terms of understanding how the role of culture and how it actually shapes our sense of self. And I think this kind of universalizing tendency to say that we have access to the universal Dharma in a way sort of opens up these practices to all these market forces, all the forces of individualism. But it's a narrative, I think, that somehow tries to present mindfulness as standing outside of history or standing outside of our social and historical context, which is impossible. But this is a key discursive element of when you privatize mindfulness and you turn it into a self-help technique. It then kind of is seen as a standalone technique. Barry Magid, who wrote the book What's Wrong with Mindfulness and What's Not, I really like his term. He calls it a foregain approach to mindfulness. So we've kind of recontextualized mindfulness within the domain of a utilitarian, pragmatic, goal-driven sort of Western sensibilities, and that that's fine. But I think what that does is it truncates other approaches to mindfulness or other ways of using mindfulness that are not necessarily focused on put it in service of the ego. In other words, so I think that's one of the trade-offs and one of the things that's being lost in the modernization of mindfulness.
So you say that the mindfulness movement is subtly propagating a sort of social amnesia. And I thought that was a really interesting term. And I believe what you mean by that is it's by propagating exclusive awareness on present moment experience, it prevents individuals from reflecting on the causes of and solutions for society's socioeconomic problems. But many people practice mindfulness in order to live a happier or more peaceful life. You know, not everyone is interested in becoming a warrior for social and economic change. So can you blame them for that?
No, I wouldn't blame them, but I think we need to become more mindful of the dominant narrative, which basically, if you say that I'm stressed, so therefore I'll turn to an app or meditate or whatever, even take a bubble bath. These can make you feel better, there's no doubt. And I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't take care of ourselves. Self-care can be a radical political act, but these are very superficial remedies to these deep-rooted structural problems, which are causing people to turn to mindfulness in the first place. So I'm really more concerned about how mindfulness can be and has been deployed to help people basically tolerate and survive within exploitive systems, rather than helping them to collectively come together in a mindful way through mindfulness programs, which could help them to exert their collective voice to challenge these structures of oppression or injustices. Now, that won't be for everyone, that's for sure. But if we're really going to claim that this is a revolution, a mindfulness revolution, then we do need to move in that direction, more towards a collective forms of mindfulness.
I think one of the greatest selling points of the mindfulness movements is the fact that it is very scientifically based and that it does have a large body of research behind it. And I think a lot of people really use this to convince others that it's an effective method to treat whatever ailment they're hoping to get help with. But is it actually as well grounded in science as we think it is?
Well, yes and no. The literature now that's coming out that's much more critical of mindfulness studies. There are many meta-analytic studies that have come out over the last 3 to 5 years, which have called into question some of the claims of significance. And of course, the big one was the JAMA study, the Journal of the American Medical Association, that was done at Johns Hopkins. That was the big one that in 2014, basically they looked at over 18,000 studies, but only 47 of them met their criteria for admission in their meta-analytic statistical study. And once you narrowed it down to those 47, then the significance looked a lot more modest than what was thought. And there have been other studies commissioned by the NIH, National Institute of Health, as well. And one in particular that came out recently was co-authored by 15 contemplative scientists called Mind the Hype. And these are people who have been some of the most prominent researchers in the mindfulness, scientific mindfulness community, coming out on their own in a very thorough article, actually, that listed kind of a litany of methodological problems with these studies. But not just that, because as the title suggests, Mind the Hype, that the hype, especially as it's communicated in the popular media, has outpaced the actual evidence. And so they own up to that in this particular article, which is good. But I think you see other issues too. For example, one of the key ones that is often talked about is experimenter allegiance. And experimental allegiance is where a person running the active control group, the active experimental group, is also someone who is either an advocate of mindfulness, or they're the key author of the article. And when you factor that out, the significance goes down considerably when you take out the experimenter allegiance effect. But you're right. Branding mindfulness with science has been a tremendous boost to its popularity. And you see, actually, this is something I wrote about earlier in another essay. It was called The Mindfulness's Truthiness Problem. So it sounds very sciencey in many ways, mindfulness feels very sciencey. But if you disentangle some of the research, you'll see that the results are modest. They're not as overblown as people have communicated them. And I think that's partly due to science communication itself. I find it fascinating that some very prominent contemplative scientists have made these really exaggerated claims in popular articles, such as the Harvard Business Review, for example. But then they're very much more circumspect in academic writings. There's a lot of hedging and there's a lot of qualifications. But there's quite a gap between the public reporting of science and the actual backstage material in academic journals. There's quite a gap between those two. On the other hand, you can also see a tremendous amount of funding that has increased in mindfulness through federal agencies and so forth. And at one time, I mentioned this, that transcendental meditation was sort of the golden child of scientific study. And I think NIH actually funded over $23 million in research funds to study TM, but that fell out of favor around 2003. And then mindfulness took up the slack, and there's like over $100 million that have been funded research studies from the National Institute of Health. So there you go. I think that it's being much more closely scrutinized than it has before by people doing these meta-analytic studies.
In your book, you primarily take a look at the mindfulness movement in the American context, not exclusively, though. And I have double nationality with the Netherlands and the U.S., and I currently live in Brussels, Belgium. And I can tell you that the mindfulness movement is in full swing here in Europe. There's, you know, all these mindfulness consultancies that have popped up in the past decade or so that teach mindfulness programs to other companies' employees. And a number of my own acquaintances and professional contacts have also participated in these mindfulness programs that their company sponsored. And generally, I think they react pretty positively to the experience. So where's the harm if a company wants to offer a mindfulness program to its employees as an extra benefit?
Well, I think the harm comes from placing the burden on the individual to be fully responsible for their own well-being in the corporate workplace. Because that means that the corporation or the company, wherever it may be occurring, can continue to do what it does. It could continue to require individuals to work 80-hour weeks. It could continue to basically exploit people in terms of not offering them adequate benefits, time off, sick days, or the fast pace of work that people are being subjected to, unrealistic workloads. There's no harm. I mean, and this is what Kevin Healy, a friend of mine, talks about, that corporations, especially you could say corporations such as Google and fairly large corporations, you don't see mindfulness programs being offered at McDonald's and people working at low wages or at Amazon warehouses. But in these larger corporations, mindfulness programs provide what Kevin Healy calls an integrity bubbles. And what he means by that small groups of employees within the corporations will get some palliative benefits from mindfulness. In other words, they can de-stress, cope a little bit better with the demands of the workplace, but continue to ignore and downplay the externalities that are being exported, the pollution, the digital pollution that's being exported by these companies. So it's kind of ironic that, take Google, for example, which has been a subject of a lot of privacy violations and ethical issues that in terms of privacy and many other quite egregious violations, they can continue to, Google engineers can continue to, through mindfulness, be better focused, better concentrated, to keep producing these technologies of distraction and addiction. So there's no harm, but there is a harm from a larger socio-political perspective. Because what we're doing is we're simply reproducing capitalist relations. We're actually using mindfulness as a way to maintain existing power structures, existing corporate policies, and so forth. So there's actually no challenge at all made whatsoever in these programs. They're very, very conservative. They're very almost colluding with the interest of capital in many ways. And it downplays the fact that these workplace stressors that people are experiencing are not just due to people's lack of mindfulness or their inability to concentrate or that they're distracted. These workplace stressors are structural. And this has been well documented by people like Professor Jeff Pfeffer at the Stanford Graduate Business School did a study on workplace stressors, found that for the large part, they're things like lack of health insurance, unrealistic workloads, bad bosses, long work hours, unrealistic time demands, all kinds of things like this, which, of course, aren't addressed by corporate mindfulness programs. So in a way, what that does is it takes the ball off the corporation and puts it into the individual to cope. And that, to me, is nothing new. We've seen that going all the way back to the 1930s and 1940s with the human relations movement. Harvard psychiatrist Elton Mayo was working with Western Electric Plant on the west side of Chicago. And one of the interesting experiments that they did is they interviewed almost all the employees at this particular manufacturing plant and asked them, you know, what's bothering you? How do you feel? And employees felt that they felt better as a result of being listened to, but nothing in the workplace whatsoever changed economically or materially. And so you see a long history of in management that we've always tried to change the subjectivity of the worker to align the employee and the worker to the interest of organizational goals. And so back in Elton Mayo's time, many of the workers in these plants were women, and he characterized them as being hysterical. That they were suffering from hysteria and what he called mental reverie, like daydreaming. And now we would call that mind wandering. So when I saw these parallels, I was just stunned because to me, it just looks like the postmodern version of the human relations movement. And so it was kind of a deja vu to come across the history and tie these two together.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Even the most dedicated proponents of the mindfulness movement would admit that mindfulness has become a little trendy. You see the term mindfulness being used as a buzzword in advertising, from anything from toothpaste to cars. And just the other day, I went to a cafe for lunch here in the European Quarter in Brussels. And the daily special was something called a mindful chicken sandwich. I have no idea what qualified it as mindful. There's kind of a vaguely pseudo-Asian pineapple sauce that it was served with. I guess maybe that's a mindful connection. But anyway, the point is basically that, you know, mindfulness sells, and people are aware of that. And of course, many companies have jumped on that opportunity to make a profit, offering anything from chicken sandwiches to in-company mindfulness programs and even mindfulness apps. Maybe some of these companies are just in it for the money, but at the end of the day, if they're filling a gap in the market and their product is helping their clients learn mindfulness and live a happier life, is there anything wrong with that?
Well, it depends on where you stand. I stand in a place that may sound quite radical for someone as a professor of management, but we have to take these corporations to account in terms of what they're not only doing to employees. I mean, if you look at some of the latest surveys that have been released, the amount of stress that people feel right now is incredible. And to only offer these individualistic solutions and to have these bad diagnoses saying that the reason is because you're just not concentrating enough. You're not, you don't really know how to focus. You don't know how to self-regulate. To me, that's politically, it's a form of political spiritual bypassing. You know, it's a form of political bypassing. And, you know, we are at the juncture now in our culture where letting corporations run amok is something that's taking us over the precipice. So I take a strong political stand in the book, and I'm not ashamed of that in terms of saying that let's stop being accomplices to the elites in these corporations. Let's stop being corporate enablers. And that's, to me, I know it's quite harsh, but I think a lot of corporate mindfulness trainers are corporate enablers. They take their money from their corporate sponsors. They're not going to bite the hand that feeds them. In that respect, okay, you know, you can keep making money. That's fine. I guess that's why my book has ruffled a few feathers in terms of calling into question some of these programs where a lot of people's livelihoods are at stake in terms of offering these programs in corporations. So, and there's a tremendous amount of money involved. The mindfulness industry is now estimated to be $1.1 billion. So if that's what mindfulness is, if it's just a commodity and it's just a temporary quick fix, apply a Band-Aid and then get back into the war zone technique, I think we got a problem.
And now, speaking of people at the top, in the book, you definitely take many of the elites in the mindfulness movement to task, particularly those in the Davos crowd and the big tech companies. But, you know, every movement has its elite figures. So what do you see as especially problematic about those in the mindfulness movement?
Well, I think it just goes to the fact that from the beginning, this movement was an elite movement led by upper middle-class white males in particular, who have the cultural capital to go to Davos, to rub shoulders with the masters of the universe. You know, it's sort of this, I think, magical thinking in a way that that if we just train these elites, that there'll be a trickle-down effect. You know, the mindful leader sort of approach. We'll train these CEOs and so forth. And then we can expect there'll be this transformation. They'll then become sort of corporate saviors and turn the corner, kind of turn the corporation into the most humanistic, ecologically responsible company in the world. These are the claims that we hear a lot, you know, the Trojan horse, the myth of the Trojan horse. That if we just sprinkle a few seeds of mindfulness into corporations, that over time we will see this social and political transformation. So At one time, Monsanto was the poster child for mindfulness. It was one of the first companies that got on board, and it was the CEO and the senior managers that were trained. A few scientists, some anecdotal stories that a couple scientists said, you know, maybe what we're doing is wrong. But that was the extent of it. We still have Roundup with us, causing cancer. We have Bill George, who was the president of Medtronic company. Then I guess he secured a position at the Harvard Business School as an executive in residence. He's been one of the most vocal people for spreading mindful leadership. And I raised this in the book about my friend David Loy, who wrote Bill George an open letter about 5 or 6 years ago, because Bill George sits on the boards of Goldman Sachs and ExxonMobil and Novartis, which I need not say any more about their track records in terms of corporate social responsibility. And he wrote an open letter asking him, well, how does your mindfulness practice actually influence your decision-making and how you interact with your board members? And do you, has your mindfulness practice infiltrated asking these hard ethical questions? And he never responded to David Loy's letter. And so I think we have to call these people out in some ways for almost their hypocrisy. And so I am definitely, I do take a political stand that I don't think we should be enabling the status quo of these companies, that we should, if we're going to do something, let's do something that really calls into question these toxic policies and practices that are causing the amount of stress that people are experiencing. And to say that it's going to trickle down is, to me, an empty promise.
With this concept of trickle-down mindfulness, there's kind of this understanding or this assumption that within mindfulness is embedded an ethical system that will automatically be fulfilled if people were only more mindful. That seems a little bit like wishful thinking to me, or a little bit like...
I think that's really disputed. I don't know, there's some recent studies that are actually questioning that claim, that mindfulness in and of itself leads to pro-social behaviors, or it leads to compassion. There's numerous studies now that are saying that it can even blunt your moral decision making. Someone, I just saw that on Facebook, some article that came out. But yeah, I mean, the corporate context is very different than the monastic context, and I don't think that we appreciate that. That recontextualization is something that involves all sorts of social forces, which we presume are benevolent. We presume that they're leading to the social good, but I think that's some assumptions that need to be questioned, interrogated, in terms of also that meditation or mindfulness meditation, in many ways, can also be a form of spiritual bypassing, not just on an individual level, but also on a political and structural level, and particularly when we see it being deployed in a corporation. So I think this should give us pause, given just how market-friendly mindfulness practices have become. I think that should give us pause in some ways to take a step back and ask ourselves, so what's really going on? I actually see some parallels to how pharmaceuticals have become so prevalent. And as a form of spiritual bypassing, mindfulness can be used to alleviate our pain or to try to dull the pain that we have or avoid it. And, you know, if we feel a little bit better, that's 10% happier. You know, if we feel 10% happier, that's good enough. And I mention this later in the book that I think suffering, which is the first noble truth in the Buddhist path, and Four Noble Truths, that suffering is often telling us that something is wrong. And that there's signals that we could pay attention to. We could be mindful of our suffering and in ways that actually don't privatize it as well. And so we're in such a complicated world now where the forces of social suffering, and I use the term social suffering because it's, I'm trying to say that, look, it's not just something that's privatized within individuals anymore. It's entangled. We have the complex orders of suffering that are entangled and hard to identify because in a neoliberal order of society, we have these other levels of suffering. So first level suffering is basically what we have been familiar with, right? At the individual level, even in Buddhism, Buddhism has been a path of individual salvation that we take full responsibility for our own delusion and mental poisons and try to liberate ourselves at an individual level. That's been pretty much the history of Western, of Asian and Western Buddhism. And I think we're at a point now where that approach needs to be rewritten in terms of, like with the Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi has been talking quite a bit about this, is that we need kind of a global mindfulness or a civic mindfulness, which clear comprehension, which is one of the key factors of mindfulness. Not just our individual mind streams, the mental toxins and kleshas within our individual mind streams, but also the sociopolitical sources of suffering, which are entangled with our personal suffering. And that's kind of a whole new paradigm, I think, that we have to move away from seeing mindfulness strictly as a therapeutic, clinical modality, although that's part of it. That's definitely part of it. But also conjoin that with a more collective or civic form of mindfulness, which can bring to bear our wisdom and compassion at a more social and political level, especially now that we're facing up to the impending ecological crisis that we're in. This is really something I think by turning critique back outwards rather than inwards, rather than an inward turn, we also need an outward turn. And if you actually look at mindfulness from a canonical perspective, it also talked about mindfulness having external focus. It's not just internal. And so I think that by seeing how the dominant discourse of stress, which has been privatized, we've seen it as a strictly personal problem, the more we can kind of shift out of that discourse, I think the better off we'll be in terms of liberating mindfulness so they become a force for social and political change, which doesn't throw the baby out with the bathwater per se. It's still, we still need to take care of ourselves. Self-care is very important, but it's self-care in community with others. And I think that one of the problems of Western Buddhism, and I've had this discussion with a few people recently, is there's kind of a privileging of silence in many domains, whether it's on retreat and so forth. Of course, there's a place for that. There's definitely a place for that. But I think that there's something lacking, I think, now in Buddhist communities. And that lack has to do with finding ways to collectively come together more in dialogue to address these more systemic and structural forces of injustice and exploitation. And so a lot of people think that, well, you know, Buddhism shouldn't be political, right? But I think there is a role for the dharmic citizen. And that's kind of developing these civic virtues. So we think about virtues from an let's say from an Aristotelian perspective of virtue ethics. But there's the idea, and at least the Greeks had this idea, that we are always political. We exist within a polis. We exist within a public space. And this is what neoliberalism has tried to destroy, is the domain of public spaces, the domain of democratic dialogue. And they had a word for people who weren't in the polis, or people who basically were apathetic. And actually, the root word, the root of idiot, idios, came from the Greeks, someone who was sort of checked out of society and not taken care of the public domain. And so when mindfulness is reduced to a self-help technique, a do-it-yourself, standalone self-help technique, then we're sort of putting aside other potentialities of mindfulness as a more civic, as a more communal, as a more transformative technique that requires a lot more solidarity. And the solidarity can come by suffering with others, which is actually one of the meanings of compassion. So I think that's a very different sort of view of mindfulness, different vision.
And I'd like to turn to one of the specific contexts in which mindfulness has been applied. And you speak about this in your book a little bit. And that's education. I know particularly in the U.S., there's been a wide range of mindfulness initiatives introduced in schools, anything from weekly lessons by an external teacher or teachers incorporating mindfulness in their individual classrooms or even entire schools adopting mindfulness practices. And so far from what I hear, the anecdotal evidence seems positive. So does mindfulness have a place in our schools?
Yeah, it's quite popular. There's no doubt about it. I think the issue that I take in the book with mindfulness in schools, again, is that most programs that you see, they don't really take into account any kind of critical inquiry into the social and economic context that are often have a lot to do with the behavioral problems that in disadvantaged neighborhoods and schools, poor academic performance, so on. So I take issue that there's almost a glaring absence of a liberating critical pedagogy that could be integrated with mindfulness in school programs. It might kind of be a teachable moment where people could be engaged, actively engaged in learning critically about the context that they're in. And so what you see primarily then is mindfulness programs which are used in such a way to help children calm down, to manage, self-regulate their anger. But there's no real questioning of why these people, why children are feeling the way they're feeling in these contexts. So that's part of the problem that I see in these programs. The other thing is that there is absolutely a paucity of research on mindfulness for children. Talk about the mindfulness scientific literature being embryonic. It's even more embryonic when it comes to children. And I think that's important because a lot of mindfulness school programs are taught in disadvantaged neighborhoods. Children could have a history of trauma. And I don't think that the mindful school teachers are trained competently to deal with trauma, although that's starting to change. I had several people. There's a mindful school program in Richmond, California, privately email me letters. And these were letters from the mindfulness teachers themselves. In other words, there was one mindfulness teacher in particular who was very experienced, had done a lot of training, and she was basically up in arms about how this particular service provider, this particular mindful school program, was hiring teachers and giving them like a 4-hour training and then throwing them into the classroom. And they were actually going to the school board and making it a public issue. So I think we have some issues there around, do we really know what we're doing when we're operating with children in these settings? And, you know, the other contested issue is something that has been coming up for a number of years, not just with mindfulness, but with yoga. And one of my colleagues, of course, Candy Gunther Brown, just came out with a book called Debating Mindfulness and Yoga in Public Schools. She's much more of an expert than I am on these legal issues, but there have been some legal challenges to mindful school programs particularly the one, I think it was in Massachusetts, was the Calmer Choice Program, actually was a target by the National Center for Law and Policy, which represents evangelical Christians, of course, in litigation. You know, that's a whole nother area, I think, that is quite contested. There are, if you look at some of the popular mindfulness programs in schools, they are using artifacts that look very Asian, you know, Tibetan bells and so forth. And of course, you could argue whether that's secular or religious. That's a kind of the binary, which is quite permeable depending on where you stand and who you talk to. But I think it is an area that my colleague David Forbes has spent most of his last 10 to 15 years trying to develop a different approach to mindfulness in schools, one that is much more critical and one which is much more integrative. So it integrates critical pedagogies with mindfulness therapeutic techniques. I have heard good news and good reports about what's going on in the New York City schools, that they are one of the few programs that have consciously tried to integrate critical pedagogies with mindfulness programs. So I think we're starting to see some movement in that direction.
And I think the ethics behind introducing mindfulness programs to schools is made only that much more complicated by the fact that, you know, certain actors within the mindfulness movement like to kind of have it both ways. They like to present a secular front, but, you know, often behind closed doors or with their own audiences, they're often using rather, you know, Buddhist jargon or speaking of the Dharma or overtly religious concepts. Now, certainly, I don't think this is the case with all of the organizations who are introducing programs into schools. But I think if there's a lack of clarity around, you know, the origins, and this is often covered up, then you're certainly going to raise questions in parents' heads about what their children are actually engaging in and if they actually want them to be engaging in these practices.
Right. I mean, it's not rocket science. Anyone can Google the word mindfulness and eventually see that it has a history tied to Buddhist traditions. So that's kind of out in plain day, plain daylight, I think. And so, yeah, you do see some parents saying, well, you know, I'm not so sure about this. And rightly so, I think. But this is what I refer to as camouflage, the idea that you turn on or the Buddhist on and off position of branding. You switch the Buddhist branding on and off depending on who you're talking to, what audience you're, what constituency you're talking to. And so if you are talking to school administrators or you are talking to federal funding agencies, you're definitely going to turn the Buddhist switch off completely. But if you're at a conference such as Wisdom 2.0 or the Mind and Life Institute, or you're you know, talking to people who you know are kind of sympathetic, then you turn the Buddhist switch on and say things that how you're teaching the Dharma. You're teaching the Dharma, but the people that we're teaching it to don't know that we're teaching the Dharma. And I've actually heard people say this quite explicitly. So I think that raises some ethical issues. If you really think that you're offering stealth Buddhism or some sort of camouflaged form of Buddhism, I think that's problematic.
Yeah, another area that I think is problematic that you introduce in your book, you know, I've been active with mindfulness within both Buddhist and academic contexts for a number of years now. And I think listeners who follow me as a host on the New Books Network probably won't be too surprised by that. I think they could probably see a recurring theme in the authors and books that I've invited to be on the podcast. But, you know, so over the years, I could tell that mindfulness was obviously becoming increasingly mainstream in society. But I never really stepped out on my own areas of interest to look at what was happening in the broader society. So one of the chapters in your book that came as a huge surprise to me was chapter 12, entitled Mindful Warriors, in which you explain how mindfulness techniques are being adapted for military training in the U.S. Now, maybe there is some way that this might be a benefit to soldiers who are dealing with, you know, just huge levels of stress on the field, or those who are suffering from PTSD back home. But this one chapter alone really jumped out at me as a warning about the potential of mindfulness to be used in truly nefarious and unethical ways. And I think, you know, obviously those familiar with Buddhist history might not be so shocked, as there are a number of historical contemporary examples of where the Dharma has been weaponized, such as in World War II Japan and so forth. And that was for a specifically militaristic purpose. But I think this one chapter and this one context really points to the fact that mindfulness movement has truly reached every corner of society, and there's no real oversight as to how it's being used. Would you like to comment a little on this point?
Right. When I first stumbled upon how mindfulness was being used in the military, I was kind of shocked. And this is a few years back when it first caught my attention. And I thought, this is really strange, because the advocates, many of the advocates who are, you know, somewhat involved in the U.S. military initiative of mindfulness, say that they're teaching the Dharma. And I'm going, well, if you're teaching the Dharma, doesn't that mean that we should have compassion even towards our enemies? Do we really engage in violence if we're teaching the Dharma? So that made me really kind of think through just how kind of distorted and perverted these practices can become. And again, that's what happens when you strip them completely, decontextualize them, instrumentalize them, turn it into basically a concentration technique that is, you know, I really don't even think what they're teaching military infantrymen. I don't really even think they're teaching them mindfulness. They're teaching them some form of attention enhancement training. But nevertheless, I took issue with how these mindfulness programs were being used for pre-combat deployment training. That is, before soldiers actually went to Iraq or Afghanistan. I have tremendous compassion for people coming back from the war. They shouldn't have been there to begin with, that are suffering from PTSD, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about programs that are designed, and this is the language they use, to optimize warrior performance, to enhance cognitive capabilities, basically to increase working memory and all these kind of cognitive functions in the service of warrior performance, and that translates to killing. Now, the argument that you will hear is that, well, we can prevent Marines from accidentally shooting a child because they'll have better self-regulation. And that's great. I mean, there's no doubt that, of course, we could save one child's life. That's well worth it. But that takes the picture off the larger issues of ethics and how we're using what supposedly is something that comes from the Buddhist tradition, how we have, as you said, weaponized it. And yeah, I also talk about how Buddhists are not angels in this, because that's exactly what happened in World War II. With the Soto and Rinzai sects of Japanese Buddhism during Japanese military imperialism. So it's happened before, and that's when basically you take bare attention or concentration, in this case they called it samadhi power, and you distort and you pervert the teachings. And you saw many Zen priests do exactly that in terms of lifting the prohibition on killing and saying basically, no, you're not actually killing someone, because you're actually showing this kind of deep experience of emptiness. So when you raise the sword, you're not really actually killing someone. It's actually an expression of compassion. It's a way to repay your debt or gratitude to the emperor. And so Japanese warriors were actually portrayed as bodhisattvas that were fearless, you know. And that, to me, is insane in a way. It's an insane perversion, very extreme example of that. But I think you see a continuum of this kind of way of decontextualizing and de-ethicizing these practices. And one of the reasons is we've begun to see mindfulness as a state of mind, which is purely a physiological state of mind, which produces a certain sort of mental state. And so that completely takes it out of the realm of politics, takes it out of the realm of ethics, and puts it into the realm of technique. When you have a technique, you can separate it from the context of nonviolence or from the context of ethics. And that's what's happened in the military.
You discuss how mindfulness has been introduced in the U.S. Congress as well as in Westminster in the U.K. I think this is a pretty interesting chapter. You're doubtful that politicians practicing or promoting mindfulness will result in a kinder politics or better social outcomes. Why not?
Well, yeah, I talk about mindful politics. I take the case of Congressman Tim Ryan, who wrote a book, A Mindful Nation, who basically sees himself, I saw recently an article, as the Zen president. He wants to be the Zen president. But if you look at the book and you read it closely, it's extremely conservative book, and it's almost right out of the neoliberal playbook, in my opinion. He's doing actually the self-help rhetoric is making individuals responsible for their own welfare. There's nothing, you know, radical in this book whatsoever. And the idea is that I refer to it as a politics of depth. In other words, what Ryan thinks is that we can solve all our political problems by going a little deeper. By practicing mindfulness, we'll be a little nicer, a little more compassionate, and we can even work better with Trump. He actually says that. But I have my doubts about that. Again, it's a therapy. It's a therapeutic way of reducing politics to therapy. And it's basically kind of a psychologizing of these problems, reframing these problems as, you know, we're not mindful enough. And if we can all just get along, if we just be a little more mindful, we can all get along a little bit better. So it you know... Ryan comes from one of the most depressed, deindustrialized regions in the United States, where it's Youngstown, Ohio, which was, of course, one of the centers for the steel industry. And it almost looks like a war zone now. And he basically makes these claims that we can make America mindful again, in my opinion. You know, like we could reclaim our American values by practicing mindfulness. But there are some political scientists that actually call that into question. Matthew Moore, who is actually has written a lot about politics and Buddhism, he argues that mindfulness practice may actually harden our opinions, actually. It may actually make us more attached to the existing opinions that we have. So I'm finding it quite kind of hard to stomach Ryan's proposals about going a little deeper. And then, of course, in the United Kingdom, the Mindfulness Nation Initiative has been quite popular. In terms, I think 200 of the MPs have gone through some sort of mindfulness program. It's been a focus of a lot of media attention. With the report that came out, I think it was back in 2015, the All Mindfulness All Party Parliamentary Group, basically, again, what they're advocating is to make mindfulness more accessible in all public sectors and including the private workplace, and that the real issue, that the only issue we have is that we have to train and get adequate funding to train mindfulness teachers so that they can be deployed in public schools, in the workplace, and in healthcare system. But again, they adhere exactly to the same sort of privatized notion of mindfulness that is prevalent. Now, one of the things I heard, I just came back from the United Kingdom, actually a couple of weeks ago, and I was talking at Cardiff University, and a woman in the audience told me a story that she said that she had been suffering from, I believe it was anorexia or something like that, some sort of eating disorder. And she really wanted to get adequate mental health treatment for this. And I guess her general practitioner said, well, you can't really get access to that healthcare until you take this mindfulness course. And it was almost like completely contraindicated for what she was suffering from in terms of focusing on body sensations and everything, the body scan practice. And that really kind of surprised me that it's a prerequisite in some healthcare sectors within the United Kingdom that you have to, in order to access the kind of mental health care that you desire, you first have to try to take a mindfulness course of some kind. I found that quite stunning.
I'd like to end our discussion with a simple question. What's the solution?
What is the solution? Well, I don't think there's one solution. First, I think we have to simply accept the fact that mindfulness, the mindfulness-only technique is insufficient to respond to the type of suffering that we're experiencing today in this society that we're living in. It's a one step in the right direction, but there are a lot more steps to go. By not looking at the social determinants of mental health, for example, which is now becoming much more legitimate. The World Health Organization, the United Nations are now saying that, you know, everything is not a disorder of the individual. Everything doesn't need to be medicalized and pathologized, that we actually need new explanatory narratives and new sort of paradigms that can help us to deal with social suffering. And that requires an expanded focus beyond the biomedical, beyond the psychological. I like to see mindfulness, and I think there are emerging trends in this direction, become a force for social change, become a civic force. And that requires then community formation. We have to put much more energy into building community, opening up the avenues for community dialogue around the problems that we face, and to look more critically and ask more challenging questions rather than just kind of paying attention to the present moment. I think that we have to go much more beyond just calming the mind. It's preliminary, it's necessary, but if it's going to become a revolution, it needs to get beyond its conservative tendencies. It needs to really kind of call into question the social and political structures that we're living in, and not be complicit in naturalizing this suffering that in terms of enabling some of these institutions that mindfulness has found itself in. So I think that requires new frameworks, whether we draw from sociology or we draw from anthropology or political science. We certainly need to expand the disciplinary scope through which we see mindfulness, and for the most part, it's been seen as a biomedical intervention. It's been seen as a clinical and psychological intervention, and those disciplines are traditionally very conservative. So I think by expanding our diagnostic models beyond the therapeutic, that allows us then to open up new sorts of collective programs, new sorts of pedagogies, which can then take into account the entangled nature of suffering and see how it's entangled personally and collectively. And that requires a lot of innovation, a lot of creativity that people on the edges are starting to do that. We could see that there was a recent article that came out in Transformation by the people in the Mindfulness for Social Change Network, which started in the United Kingdom. And they chronicled and had a nice inventory of some of the I would say, more social or civic-oriented mindfulness programs that are being experimented with, primarily in the United Kingdom, actually. So I think we can revolutionize mindfulness and turn it into a force that maybe resembles in some ways a liberation theology in terms of how we can marry together spiritual practice with progressive and radical action. And again, that really takes a new vision, which takes into account the shared vulnerabilities that we all have, and we all experience suffering, but we experience it differentially. It's not equal. And we need to kind of see how mindfulness has been primarily something for upper middle class elites. A form of white privilege has been something that's been entangled with the mindfulness movement, and to disentangle that require a whole different sort of approach that cannot ignore, cannot bypass the interrogation of power and systems. And that requires, again, new forms, new pedagogies. The 8-week standardized program is not cast in stone. And so there are all different ways that we can approach it that open it up to these more civic and collective and social movements towards a more social mindfulness movement.
Well, Ron, I'm pretty sure you're going to have your hands full with this book for the foreseeable future. But once things quiet down a little bit, do you have any projects that you would like to work on?
I actually want to get back to my own podcast, The Mindful Cranks. I have kind of a long queue of people that I want to interview. So I think that'll be my my first priority in the fall.
Well, Ron, I'd like to thank you again for coming on the podcast to discuss your book, Make Mindfulness, How Mindfulness Became the New Capitalist Spirituality, published by Repeater Books.
Okay, thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to New Books in Buddhist Studies with Alex Carroll. If you're interested in learning about other new books in Buddhist Studies, head over to newbooksnetwork.com or search for New Books Network wherever you get your podcasts. Audio used with permission from Musique Délicieuse and is taken from the song Small Flower by Para Furkuva.